Welcome to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast with Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend.
So Tim, today we're joined by some other family law podcasters from Canada. So we've got Darren and Rob from Divorced and Done. And I'm really excited to chat to you guys today because we can't get out and about with the COVID restrictions that are on at the moment, but we can talk to people internationally about the things that really interest us. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having us. It's a thrill to be with you from way across the pond. So
It's great to be here. This is my first time in Australia, albeit digitally. So thank you for having us.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I've never been to Canada.
No,
either.
I don't know if you have, but I'm dying to go.
Yeah, me too. So today's discussion is really a bit of a compare and contrast about our family law systems. And Tim and I thought it might be interesting to get some feedback from you about things that are really similar and things that are different in terms of the experiences that we're having with clients at the moment. So do you want to tell us a bit before we get started just about what your practices are like in Canada and where you work and what kind of matters that you're doing?
Sure. Why don't I jump in? It's Darren to start. And so a bit of background, Rob and I went to law school together at the University of Calgary in Alberta. And it's been 10 years since we started law school. And so we've had this sort of running conversation between ourselves going through what we call articling or apprenticeship as we complete law school and then as young lawyers. And we both wound up doing family law independently. We've never worked at the same firm with each other, but we've mirrored each other's careers in many ways. And we ultimately just decided to start this podcast, Divorced and Done, earlier this year. And the whole message involved in our podcast has been, how do we get people divorced and done? And obviously, it's a Canadian-driven podcast, but it's focused on just sort of helping people move through what can be a complex process in a step-by-step matter, in a simple manner. And in terms of, I guess, my specific practice, so I practice out of what we call the North Okanagan in British Columbia. It's sort of our wine country, not nearly as good as Australians' wine, I'm sure. I maintain a full-time family and divorce practice at a smaller firm here in Vernon in the North Okanagan. So I'll turn it over to you, Rob.
Thank you, Darren. Picking up on Darren's comments, it is so great being with both of you here today, because as Darren suggested, we have been friends for basically 10 years now, and it was our phone calls and our regularly engaging with each other going, oh, I don't know what I'm dealing with, how about this, that led to creating this podcast. And Darren particularly was the driving force behind all of this, particularly on TikTok, where he engaged with your colleague, James Apache from Coffee and a Case Note, who I know really encouraged Darren to say, okay, we're doing this. Here's this lawyer in Australia who has a fantastic online presence. I think we could do something like this in Canada, because there's not a lot of family law content in Canada, either podcasts or digitally generally. So we've stepped into that space, obviously, in large part thanks to you, which is why it's so great being here with you.
Shout out, James Apache.
Absolutely. So my
experience
was like...
Oh, sorry, go ahead, Rob.
No, I was going to say my practice, much like Darren's, I am 95% family law. In Calgary, Alberta, which is just a little bit east of Darren in our Rocky Mountains. And that's generally what I've been doing since practice.
I was just going to say on James, my experience with him, not to make this about James, but I'm scrolling through TikTok and I see this guy rapping about shareholders' remedies in a forest. And I'm like, what is going on with this dude? But it was awesome. He was so totally genuine, and I've had a fun time.
I'm always impressed with people that can use technology. I'm the most technologically illiterate person in the world. So I think anyone who can TikTok, Snapchat, whatever the thing is, I'm always impressed, because I just think that's go for gold.
No, we're lucky. And, you know, James is a bit of a force of nature, and obviously was a bit of a supporter and promoter of us starting our podcast within the firm. And you know, that's how I listen to your podcast as well. And, you know, it's interesting when you listen to your podcast about some of the really similar issues that do kind of besiege us in our practice. Because I think in your last podcast, you were talking about just having Thanksgiving, which is obviously not a, like a holiday that we celebrate in Australia. But as I was listening to you guys talking about it, in my mind, the first thing I was thinking was another holiday to put into parenting arrangements and orders and to have to coordinate, you know, who does what and how you get from A to B and exchange the kids. And you guys had a really interesting conversation about, you know, trying to create positive outcomes for your clients in terms of, you know, their experiences around those special holidays. And also, I don't know, you called it the gray revolution or gray...
great tsunami. The emerging tsunami divorce trend of people over 60 getting divorced. Grandmas and grandpas getting divorced.
Really,
yes.
Interesting. And quite similar here too. Like, I think it is kind of a big social dynamic at the moment of older people getting divorced. And you were talking about, you know, how do grandma and granddad or whatever you want to call them will navigate, you know, hosting Thanksgiving or other events like that. And it's really interesting to hear these issues in, you know, another context, but they are, you know, the kind of basic common problems we're all facing in terms of helping our clients through these processes.
Yeah. And so we've fashioned them what we call the divorced and done steps. So there's no magic to these steps. They just largely encapsulate the broad areas of what we would refer to as corollary relief under our federal divorce act. So the things you have to deal with as part of a breakdown of a marriage, but they're the same items you'd have to deal with if you're an unmarried couple, what we call common law couples. And so they basically are, you start step one of our steps are you got to live separate and apart. Right. In order to get as a threshold item in Canada to get divorced, divorce is a federal matter. You have to live separate and apart from your spouse for a full year. Doesn't mean you can't file something or resolve all the issues, the other issues as part of our steps within that 1 year time period, but you have to start living separate and apart. And our big message for our listeners is separate and apart does actually mean separate and apart. Doesn't mean you live in different bedrooms in the same house, although that's possible. We have addressed that on our podcast because we do often see clients that go, for economic reasons, we want to live in the same household. Not a good idea for many practical reasons, right? So step one, live separate and apart. And then we start moving through our other steps, which include, you know, parenting, what used to be called custody. Built into that is parenting time. So where are the kids going to be? And then parental decision-making. Flowing from that, once you know what the parenting arrangement is, your third step is child support, which is largely formulaic. It's just basically table amounts. And so that step has been made pretty simple by virtue of our child support guidelines. We just need to know what someone's income is. That in and of itself can be complex, but then you move to dividing your stuff. That's the next step. So dividing all your property and your debts, that's a provincial issue. So that's decided on a province by province basis, but almost uniformly across all provinces in Canada, save for Quebec. The French civil code system we have in that province, we generally just divide all that stuff equally. That's generally the presumption. And then after all that's done, you look at spousal support or what we used to call alimony. Once you move through those steps, we say you're divorced and done. So we've just simplified the items of corollary relief into little buckets or little items that you move through step by step by step. And what we like doing is saying, well, because we often get listener questions as part of our podcast as well, and that's one thing we really do like engaging with the public as a public legal information forum. So to that end, you know, we get a lot of questions and people's minds are, of course, because they're going through a separation as a listener, they're sort of dumping a bunch of information into an email to us, right? And so it's what we like doing is moving them through that process. Well, are you living separate and apart? And if you haven't yet, just focus on that. Don't focus on the spousal support and the dividing your stuff because that's way down the road. Let's get you separate and apart. Once you're there, you're emotionally ready to move on. You know, you're physically, you've moved apart. You know, then let's move to step two, which is parenting. So that's our legal system in a nutshell from a family and divorce perspective at its simplest. We've just put it into little steps. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's quite interesting because, I mean, there's so many similarities there, a few differences. But when I speak to a client embarking on like a family law process, I generally break it up into four things as well, which are kind of the four big ticket items that people need to move through in our separation process. So the first is, I think, I don't know if you agree with this, Tim, but it's probably, you know, a bit of a mixed bag as to whether or not people are living separately and apart when they, you know, embark on a family law process in Australia. Like, obviously, lots of people are. But similarly, we do have a lot of people who are still cohabitating until they resolve their other issues while they go through the process. So to get divorced in Australia, we have a similar, I guess, threshold issue, which is the only ground for divorce in Australia, which is a federal jurisdiction. So, you know, similar across the country, is that that there's been an irretrievable breakdown of the marriage as evidenced by 12 months of separation. Mm. But parties can file evidence of living separately and apart and being separated and still get divorced. So that kind of physical separation is not necessarily a huge requirement. And lots of people, you know, kind of hold off on their divorce. Like, it's kind of the last thing that people worry about because people are most, usually most kind of interested in getting their parenting and property stuff done. And so you'll find, you know, before that 12-month period, you know, the second thing to work through is what happens with your kids, like you know, who they live with, what happens with parental responsibility, what time they spend with, you know, each parent. And the reason why that's kind of, you know, issue two when we talk to clients is that that can have a direct impact on what happens with property. So there is no kind of, there's no presumption about what will happen with property under the Family Law Act, which deals with both married and, you know, de facto couples, which I guess are your common law couples. But, you know, we kind of have this process where we look at the contributions each party's made. We look at their respective future needs, which is why it's important to know what's happening with the kids. And, you know, the overall issue is to work out, is the split just and equitable with respect to parties' assets and liabilities and super. So it might be a little bit different there. And maybe one of the differences that I can see from what you just said is, you know, looking at that, those other steps. I mean, we do have a child support system, which is formulaic and administered by a government agency. But alimony is not really a common part of our system. So, you know, that needs issue, I guess, for alimony or spousal support is dealt with in that step of looking at parties' respective future needs, and having a separate order or arrangement for ongoing support is probably less common in terms of what, you know, people get. Do you think that's a fair assessment, Tim, or have I totally mucked that up?
No, I'm kidding. No, it's true. And I guess the thing I'm fascinated about, so we have a federal act, it's called the Family Law Act, and thinking about how you guys work in Canada, because you've got provinces. So divorce is your federal act. What's your federal act called? The Divorce Act.
The Divorce Act.
And then property settlements and so on are done within each province. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a feature of our constitution. So it dates back to 1867 when we sort of gradually became a nation because we didn't, we weren't revolutionaries. We were just loyalists and gradually came about things in a polite way, as British Canadians did. So we developed the British North America Act and just divided our federation, different powers to our provinces and states, and just our province and federally, excuse me. And it just, by how it was worked out, provinces have the right to deal with property. So as part of that interpretation of our constitution, dividing property as part of a divorce or common law separation is determined at a province level. So each province has the authority to make its own statutes respecting how couples will divide their property upon separation. And like I said, our presumption is normally all that stuff is just divided equally. It sounds like your process there, if I understand from a federal level, that your Family Law Act it is not presumed to be divided equally. It is a just and equitable array of factors. That's quite interesting.
Absolutely. And I mean, look, in terms of, I guess, different states and territories having different powers, for a long time, we had this, and I'm interested to know how you guys navigate this, because for a while, our like common law or de facto couples were separate to the Family Law Act. So their property settlements were dealt with in accordance with each state and territory, but those powers eventually got referred, so we're now all under the one act. But we did have situations where Tim, for example, is in a place called the Australian Capital Territory, which is our where, you know, Parliament House is, and it's this tiny kind of territory within New South Wales where I am, and our common law or de facto systems for property settlement were quite different in the sense that the ACT had a similar process to, you know, married couples. So there was that consideration of future needs, but in New South Wales, they didn't have that step. So you would find for a while before the powers were referred to the Commonwealth that people would kind of jurisdiction shop depending on what was going to get you the best outcome. So I wonder, is that kind of a feature of what happens in Canada as well? Do people kind of plan and move for better outcomes, or is it so similar everywhere that you're not really going to get much of a difference?
It's interesting because we used to see occasionally, very rarely, a little bit of jurisdictional shopping because our property regimes, again, being provincial, you would see that. Darren and I actually worked on a file together a couple years ago, with him being in BC and I'm in the province next door in Alberta, where that did come up a little bit. But increasingly, most of our provincial pieces of legislation are more in line. So you're getting that, I don't want to immediately say presumption of half, but presumption of equal division, whether you're married or not married. So those shopping pieces don't really come up. And the hallmark of all of that, even traditionally in the past, was you'd have to be resident or resident some in one of the jurisdictions for a year before you could even file. So the whole notion of people taking off, trying to file elsewhere, it really wasn't so much of an issue because of those barriers that were just there.
And then thinking about the process, so you've got divorce, which is federal. What's the court in Canada which you would make a divorce application?
So under our Divorce Act, it must be a superior level court. So they're called different things in different provinces. In British Columbia, we call it the Supreme Court of British Columbia. Beneath that, we have a provincial court. Provincial court doesn't have any jurisdiction to grant a divorce. But if you wanted to, if you want to get technical, you could bring all your corollary relief items and have them decided in provincial court, save for property division items. It has no jurisdiction to deal with it. So you could bifurcate your proceedings. You could ask for a divorce in the Supreme Court. You could deal with your parenting issues, child support and spousal support in provincial court. That never makes sense. So more often than not, married couples end up, if they are litigating anything, they ultimately have to get divorced. So if they agree on everything and do a separation agreement, they're just going to ship that in for filing to the superior level court, called Supreme Court in BC. But if you're going to litigate over anything, it goes to the superior level court as well. But they're called different things in different provinces. So where Rob is, where I used to practice, Court of Queen's Bench of Alberta, Ontario is called the Ontario Superior Court of Justice. So there's no uniform court name for superior level courts across the provinces. They can call it different things. I think there's quite a few Court of Queen's Benches.
That's a great name for a
court. A few Supreme Courts, but... Yeah. So there's no uniformity of court names across Canada. So it's a little weird in that sense.
What's our really long court name now, Tim?
We have the Federal Circuit and Family Court of Australia.
Yeah,
we've heard all about the unification of your court system.
We're really excited about it. There's a lot that's come out. The courts released their central practice direction. We have a new case management pathway. Things have been consolidated, and I think we as practitioners now, the court officially opened its doors on the 1st of September, and we're already seeing the implementation of massive change. It's really positive, really, really positive. The court's hired so many more registrars, you know, it's resourced, things are happening, and things are moving. It's actually, you know, what are we, nearly 2 months down the track, and we're already seeing big changes. It's fantastic.
The other thing, and it's something that family lawyers have kind of been crying out for a long time. I think we've felt really under-resourced with our judicial officers. There was a bit of a erosion over, you know, the last, I think, 10 years of, you know, not replacing judicial officers when they retire. You have to retire at 70 as a judicial officer in our courts. But, you know, there's been a, like with our new system, it seems like they've just had a complete, you know, change in terms of attitude, and there's been a whole bunch of new appointments as well of judicial officers. So we're quite excited about what that means for timeframes in terms of, you know, clients who eventually, you know, have to litigate if they can't otherwise resolve matters. But, I mean, what are the kind of timeframes that people experience in Canada generally in resolving their matters or, you know, going to court if they have to go down that path?
I always say to folks when they come and meet with me, litigating or not, if we can avoid litigation, likely even the best case scenario where everyone has agreement, by the time we get to prepare an agreement, prepare supporting documents for court, and process your divorce, even in best case scenario, you're likely looking at 3 to 6 months. So okay. I tell everybody, from best case scenario to even unfortunately worst case scenario, this is likely a 6 to 18 month process. Right now, if you're on more of a litigated track and booking things here in Alberta, trials are booking, as I understand, on average for a 3 to 4 day trial, about a year. And yeah. You mentioned it, so I want to bounce that exact same question back to you in Australia. If you've tried to do an alternative dispute resolution process or try to resolve things out of court as much as you can, you just can't get agreement either on some or all of your issues. How long is it going to take you to get into court and get to some ultimate determination of those pieces? Or can you do it in a series of interim applications along the way?
I think it's a combination of both. And I think that usually it's 1 to 2 years for a hearing. That's the kind of guideline as to what's currently happening. The court's bringing that back. And then obviously there's the opportunity to have, you know, interlocutory applications and do whatever needs to happen as the matter progresses on the, you know, trajectory that it has. The process now is with the case management pathway with registrars getting quite involved. It's the matter is, I guess you could say there's a more structured approach to the litigation in terms of the court forward facing and looking at things. So the registrars have got their, you know, mechanism. We're bringing them back. We're doing all sorts of different things. It's a real kind of, it's like triage when you go to, you know, the emergency department at hospital. You see the first nurse there and they, you know, suggest what we can do, how we can move things along. That process has very much been adopted by the court, and that's what we're seeing now to try and pull things back.
Yeah, and I think Tim's right in terms of timeframes. Like, it's, you know, we're in a kind of state of flux at the moment in terms of seeing ultimately what these massive changes will do. But previously, you know, it could take parties a really long time to get a resolution if they went to a final hearing. And I think the statistics were, I mean, less than 5% of all matters that start in a litigation process actually get to that point. So there's really directed steps along the way to force people to try and resolve their matter. But, you know, as a first principle in our practice, and I think, you know, especially with some of the new processes that we're required to do, because we're now required to show that parties have genuinely tried to resolve their matters before you go to court, and there are certificates and things that you need to demonstrate that. I think as a first principle, Tim and I are really into saying to clients, all the things that you can do in a court and ultimately have a judge make a decision about, you can actually do before you go to court in, you know, having a mediation or having settlement conferences and exploring the issues. And, you know, you might not have someone else make the decision for you, but that's an amazing, you know, opportunity, because your outcome will be so more specific and personalized to your circumstances. And I think listening to your podcast, you guys are, you know, absolutely in that camp as well.
Yeah. So I actually wanted to talk about, oh, sorry, Rob, I wanted to briefly jump on your first episode I listened to. You talked about what's one thing your family system could do better overall. And I think you both said resources. And I thought about that. And I think that's a great thing. Right? I think our public sector should provide resources for people engaged in a court process. But Rob and I have talked about this, and I think one of the best ways to help people move through a separation or divorce is to empower them to not have to use those resources. So we don't want you to take up court time if you don't have to. What can we do as a profession to educate you? What can you do to take control of your own life and work with your soon-to-be ex-spouse to navigate those issues and make your own solution? Because I'm guessing, unlike Australia on this point, many of our judges, both at a provincial court level or superior court level, don't get appointed having practiced specifically in family law. That's not to take anything away from the judges we have sitting at any level of our bench across this country. Many are excellent at determining family law issues when litigating, but many of them are appointed from a commercial litigation background, or they're crown prosecutors or defense lawyers or civil litigators. They don't come from a strict family law background. We don't have judges dedicated full-time to determining family law matters in many parts of our country, mine included. Rob's in a bigger center. There are certain provincial court judges where he lives that have a full-time docket load or caseload of just dealing with family cases. But where I practice in a quasi-rural area of the country, the judges that I appear in front of are not only hearing family cases, they're also hearing criminal cases, and they're hearing civil litigation cases, and they're bouncing around all those things, and all of those areas of law are fighting for their time. So that creates some problems in terms of the delay coming back to getting court time for these things. It's a huge barrier for people. So stripping this right back, if you can solve your own matter, do it. And sometimes lawyers happen to get in the way of that and convince their own clients to not settle when all they do is want to settle. And that's what we're trying to achieve. That's ultimately what you guys are trying to achieve on your podcast too, is empowering more knowledge, spreading knowledge, giving the public information so that they can help themselves move through a difficult
phase. You said one thing there that I just want to touch on is that you said, so your judges in Canada, do you operate on a docket system? Is that how they work? So when you file your proceedings, you get assigned a judge and that judge case manages it all the way through. Is that how that works?
When I say docket, no. So that's what we would call case management. When I said docket, what I mean is they might be sitting, I guess what we would call chambers, right? So they'll do a chambers date, and we'll have a docket list, right? The docket court, and they're determining all those matters. And in many of those courtrooms on chambers days or docket days, they're not just family matters on the list. There's commercial matters on the list, and they're bouncing from matter to matter. So that's what I meant by the phrase docket. So we don't have case management as a presumption. You can apply in certain instances to get a judge to case manage your case. I would say, Rob, that I've never seen that in my family practice at all. That'd be quite rare.
It's exceptionally rare. Case management, it's less of a thing now in Alberta. We used to see it more regularly, and it was reserved for only the most high conflict of matters, where people were going back to docket or original chambers, where you can just make an application to come forward again and again and again. So different judges were always hearing a matter fresh every time, to the point that a judge would say, holy smokes, there's been so much conflict here. We need one justice to manage this, to hear the whole thing through to the end for efficiency's sake. But we're moving away from that.
I mean, we have similar issues. I mean, because we have a specialist court generally to hear these matters, you've got judges who are kind of just dealing with, you know, the family law process. But, you know, sometimes they have come from backgrounds outside of family law, so it might take a while for them to, you know, really develop an affinity with the issues that are at play for our clients. But coming back to, you know, putting the court to one side, I mean, you said two really interesting things. And one is, you know, like kind of helping or training your clients to, you know, not go to court to resolve their issues, and as lawyers, encouraging that. And I mean, I say this to Tim all the time. It would almost be, you know, extraordinary to have a client come and see you in a first appointment who says, I just want to go to court. I want to litigate everything. I want to have the worst experience ever. Like, clients never say that in the real world. Like, when someone comes to see me, they're always saying, look, I want to keep this as amicable as possible. I've got these tricky issues that I need some assistance with that I haven't been able to resolve myself, but, you know, I want a solution. I don't want to litigate. And I presume that's, you know, kind of, I mean, I think it's part of the human condition, but I presume that's what you guys probably find as well.
Absolutely. As you say, no one comes to us at first instance saying, hello, I want the barn burner trial of the century.
Yeah.
For sure. Sometimes that happens. And I just say for our own sanity as practitioners, hopefully it is rare and there's only one or two of those in any calendar year. Because I know they can take up a lot of time, not only for clients, but for lawyers. Yeah. But Darren and I, our goal is always to say to all of our clients, of course, how much of your own issues can you solve yourselves?
Because
who knows what's right for you and your family, even though you're separated and you're not together anymore as romantic partners, you're still a family.
Yeah. And I mean, that's, I guess, part of the kind of philosophy we have as well, that, you know, at the end of the day, part of the family law process as a solicitor is, you know, assisting your clients in maybe developing some new ways to communicate and resolve conflict or issues, because, you know, they've separated. So they've obviously, there's, you know, been an issue that they've been unable to resolve. But at the end of the day, you know, we as lawyers get to unplug from their matters and go and do other work with other clients. And these parties are left there to be able, like, you know, having to resolve things together, you know, into the future. And, you know, part of this process is an opportunity to give them some tools to never have to come and see a lawyer again to resolve some of this stuff, because then, you know, they've got tools from the process to be able to sort stuff out more constructively moving forward.
That's, I mean, that's really our goal. And coming back to the client that comes in and maybe says they would like a fight, I find normally just telling them about the costs that changes their tune fairly quickly. So, no, I mean, really at its core, I mean, our process is basically, you want to separate from someone fairly quickly on, no matter what province you're in, you're going to start exchanging financial disclosure. And really, I find most of my work is done in chambers, right? Many of my clients do not have money for a trial on these matters, because, you know, in terms of, we talked about getting to trial takes a long time for court scheduling. There's lots of back and forth. The costs are astronomical. So normally after one or two chambers appearances, which typically necessitate an affidavit and application materials and me standing in court, given my spiel, it costs a lot of money. So one or two of those chambers appearances, and people are kind of exhausted from the process. They've gotten litigation fatigue. And really what they've seen, particularly on parenting matters, is that they think they're going to go in and maybe punish their ex, right? So this is a punishment focused exercise. And of course our family system is, and I already know yours is as well, it's not punishment focused, it's forward focused, right? It's not punitive in nature. We're not punishing someone for maybe some misconduct they did 5 years ago. We're a best interests of child focused area of law. And on that point, I maybe wanted to ask you, turn this over to you. Rob and I have done some episodes or talked on the issue of how do we ascertain children's voices through court if parents are going through court? How do we allow them to have a voice, if any? And in Canada, we have a couple of options. One is appointing a children's lawyer is a possibility. In some provinces, that's more common. In some, it's very rare. It changes by province based on the various statutes. And the other areas, you can engage an expert, typically a psychologist or at minimum a trained counselor who's going to meet with the child and the parents and any relevant third parties to come up with recommendations, typically an expert, and give an opinion on what they think the parenting arrangement should be. But those are kind of our two big areas in terms of getting a child's voice. We don't ask kids to come to court and have them speak behind closed doors with the judge. We don't do that anymore. Although I understand that that happened at one point, but certainly not when during my time practicing. But those are kind of the two big areas of getting children's voices heard. What's the experience like in Australia?
I guess it happens at different stages. There are a number of different things along the trajectory of a matter where those issues can be brought to the forefront. And I guess it might be helpful to say at the outset, when a court is making a determination in a parenting matter, there's a section of the Family Law Act which sets out the primary and additional considerations of what a court's got to go through. And one of those things and the additional considerations is the children's wishes or views as to what they want. And, you know, that's a bit of a vexed issue because, you know, some children might be 10 years old, but they've got wisdom beyond their years. Some children might be 10 years old and they're quite mature and don't have the capacity to make an informed view as to what they want and what they want their circumstances to be. But at a couple of stages, so for instance, you commence your proceedings, you go straight to court. It's quite common that the court will make an order for what we call an 11F report or a child inclusive conference. And what happens with that is that everyone goes to court, everyone's interviewed, the children are interviewed by a psychologist who's employed by the court, and they'll prepare a short report which sets out what the issues are, a little bit of information, things that need to be considered. And that goes before the judge to kind of assist to narrow the issues and talk about what's going to happen and what the children are thinking about, what the issues are and so on and so forth. So that's kind of at the outset. And then like what you said there with your report, there's a formal process with that. We have a family report, it's called, or a single expert report if you're facilitating that privately. The family report is a report that's prepared within the court. So they've got the psychologists that work within the court and they'll receive orders and they'll make directions in relation to that and facilitating that process. And they'll read all of everyone's court documents, their material, and form a view as to what should happen. And also as part of that process, they interview the children and interview the parties. So that's kind of a bit later down the track in terms of the litigation process. But then, sorry, excuse me. We'll cut that out. there's also, we have the exact same thing as well as the independent children's lawyer, it's called here. And Gill's one, she's been one for many, many years. And it's a statutory appointment where a lawyer is appointed to assist the court to make a determination as to what arrangements are in the best interests of the children.
Yeah, and I think probably, you know, from the sounds of it with your system, even though there are these processes to identify views if they're relevant and if those views, you know, can be kind of assessed as validly held or, you know, free of influence and other nefarious issues, the court is still, and I think most practitioners are still, you know, very concerned about minimizing the involvement of children in these processes because, like, you know, it's sort of a widely held view that, you know, kids are aware of conflict between their parents. Obviously, when their parents separate, they're aware of that separation process, you know, in a very, you know, immediate sense. But, you know, the exposure of children to those kind of bigger issues and litigation and so forth is kind of considered to be, you know, a bit of a last resort. So getting views and, you know, information from kids is tried, you know, the courts try and do it as sensitively as possible. Sometimes it is really helpful because I think, you know, a lot of literature, you know, is out there exploring how kids may be giving feedback to their parents that's based on, you know, them trying to minimize their role in the conflict rather than, you know, views that they hold or attitudes that they have because, you know, kids are trying to navigate how to, you know, manage their parents in this, you know, conflicted situation and they're not necessarily mature enough to do that in a way that's really protective for them. But, you know, sometimes getting that information about their views and things is really important and helpful for the parents ultimately to make a decision. But sometimes, similarly, it's unnecessary. I mean, if parents are not that far apart and the issues are not about, you know, views or, you know, perhaps more, you know, problematic issues in a family dynamic, you know, I think solicitors and certainly courts can also take the view that they shouldn't be involved at all in that process if possible.
We have a much more ad hoc process than what Tim described. That seemed, that 11F seemed like a quite handy tool to have completed at the outset. And I assume there's no cost for that out of pocket, or if there is any, it's nominal.
Not if it's a court-based process. So, I mean, there's this tension in our system where if the court can have parties pay for things, it will try and require them to do so because of the resources of, you know, the government. But, you know, if parties are employing an expert before they go to court, obviously they're paying for that privilege and that process to do those reports. If they're in a court process, those early reporting options are funded by the court, so parties are not paying for it. Later on, if it's a court-based report rather than a single expert report, then, you know, the court is paying for it. And with independent children's lawyers, those are funded through the relevant state and territory legal aid systems, but parties are required to make a contribution to those costs if they're able to.
I know, Rob, you've been children's counsel. We don't have special designations for it, but we've talked about that. It's been both of Rob and I on separate occasions have been appointed through what we call legal aid. Most lawyers that are appointed through legal aid certificates to be a lawyer. You can hire a private lawyer. In order to get any appointment of any children's expert or lawyer, there has to be an order for it at first instance from a court. So an application would have to be made for it in any instance. And I find if the children are kind of beyond the age of eight and up, a court would probably just say, yeah, we would do well to have their views and wishes heard, right? We want to have that information. The tail doesn't always wag the dog, right? Just because, And I think clients often think, well, little Jimmy's going to say he loves me and doesn't want to be with dad. So that's going to end everything. Great. We'll just get the lawyer and that'll be wonderful. And of course that doesn't happen. So
Is there specific training that your children's lawyers have to go through in Canada?
I think on that piece, no, but my understanding is there's special designations in Australia for various parts of being a lawyer here in Canada. Like, they just let anyone become a lawyer. Like, I'm a lawyer, like, for God's sakes. No. No, once you become a lawyer, we don't really have special designations, special training that's required. You don't need to be, you don't even need to have certification to be a mediator or arbitrator. Anyone can do them. Oftentimes there are people that are certified as mediators. But I mean, Rob, on that point, we did an episode on certifications and that. Do you want to speak to that point?
Yes, there are, of course, optional training that some folks do undertake and you can do. But as Darren said, we are barristers and solicitors is the full title in Canada. And just by virtue of having that designation, you're free to appear in any court and really undertake any work as long as you're generally competent without further particular training.
Yeah, wow. That's the thing is that we have lots and types of different training and there's like, you know, when you'll become an independent children's lawyer or anyone who wants to do it, there's a training process and a certification process with that as well. You know, there are all these checks and balances, like, you know, Gill's an accredited specialist in family law, which is an accreditation by the New South Wales Law Society, or every law society does it. And I've just done that too. Like, there are so many different avenues of upskilling and training and, you know, gateways. You need the key to unlock the door to kind of move in and move into these roles in your role as a lawyer.
Well, it's probably a good thing. I mean, what we do is we just pay out more insurance claims. And so our insurance rates just go up. You know, just,
pretty much.
I'm just joking. So obviously we have codes of conduct. So, I mean, we're not supposed to ethically undertake work that we don't feel competent to do. And I find for
the
most part,
we are required to be competent.
Right. Yeah. So I find for the most part, people that practice, and it's becoming more common across the board in our country, they will specialize in an area of law. I think if you went back in time 20 years ago or more, you would find, particularly in rural Canada, you would find lawyers that do all sorts of things, right? They would do wills, they'd do criminal defense, they would do a bit of family law. They're a mixed bag of anything, right? Because the market demands that they be that, because that's where they are. They're more rural, so they're just going to do different areas of law. But I find even now being, I live in a city of 40,000 people, so fairly small city. I just designate myself to family practice, and I'm more than busy enough to do that. I don't need to pick up other areas of law to diversify my practice whatsoever. And it sure makes practicing a whole lot easier if my mind's not bouncing from what's the criminal code say to, you know, what is this employment law thing, to just focusing on family law, right? It's complex enough that just focusing on one area of law is important. So I find we've sort of self-selected instead of mandatorily requiring we do designations. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I think that's important. But I find most of us have just sort of fallen into line on that front.
Yeah, I should clarify, even though we do kind of like specialist accreditations and do things. We do have a similar system in that you can, you know, if you become a solicitor, you can practice in other areas as well. So, I mean, we have the same thing. If you're living in a small town, you might be a generalist practitioner doing a number of things. But, you know, certainly in our jurisdiction, I think sometimes people look at family law and think, gee, that seems like a really easy area of practice to work in. But, you know, it is quite complicated because it brings in often lots of other different areas of law that kind of intersect with the issues that we're dealing with. And also there's that whole, you know, kind of vicarious trauma element of dealing with people, you know, constantly who are going through the worst part or experience of their life. So I think it's an area where, you know, it's really hard to dip your toe in and just do from time to time. I think you're all in or all out. You know, from my perspective, yes,
it is full enough. It is a full enough practice. On that point, you guys have mentioned this previously in some of your episodes around the edges. You said what makes the best family lawyer, and you sort of hinted at it. But what do you both most love about your jobs, and what do you really like about your podcast? Well, I'll throw it to Gil first.
Oh, I was going to say Tim can answer first and say. I mean, in terms of the job, look, I think family law was something that I fell into just by virtue of that's what I got a job in. So it was like I'm employed. I'm a family lawyer now. But you know, I think it suits my personality in that I like, you know, meeting people and talking to them. You know, I'm a pretty social creature. You know, there's a real problem solving element to the work that we do, which can be quite, you know, it's challenging, but it's also quite satisfying when you help someone get through a problem that can be, you know, different with every family dynamic or matrix that you have to work through. And although going to court is not what we want for our clients, going to court can be really fun. So, I mean, you know, the court process is a bit of theatre. So I do enjoy that litigation aspect of it. And we get to do it less and less because we're encouraging our clients not to. But for the lawyers, it can be, you know, quite spicy and fun. And in terms of the podcast, a bit like you guys, Tim and I are not in this, even though we work for the same firm, Chamberlain's has offices in different locations. So we are not currently located in the same office. We, you know, in less lockdown times, we're able to visit freely between our offices. But I think it's a really good opportunity for Tim and I just to be able to talk through some of these issues. We talk, you know, probably about 10 times a day anyway about our matters. But, you know, it's fun to do it outside of the context of just talking about work and files.
I agree with that. I think everything that you've just said sums it up. I'm a little bit more bullshy about saying I'm a litigation lawyer. That's where my practice is. That's what I do day in, day out. And obviously, while it's a last resort, it's where I guess different lawyers have different skills. Some are better at drafting contracts. My skill set's court, and that's what I enjoy doing. And family law is very fast-paced. They're very real issues. You know, we're not litigating over sometimes we aren't, you know, terms of a contract. It's, you know, real life. This is people's children. This is their finances. This is their, you know, their life. And the seriousness of those issues I find fascinating in the way that the law deals with them. It's fascinating.
And I guess, you know, we should throw that question back to you guys. I mean, what's the thing that drives you daily to work in family law and, you know, do your very efficient podcast?
I think for us, it's the opportunity to help people, as you said, same idea, get through those issues. Both for Darren and I know for me particularly, of course, we do litigate, but it's not my main focus. And for me in this podcast and in my practice, there's no greater joy than working with people going, holy smokes, we solved some of these issues more efficiently or more quickly than we thought we could. And we got to the finish line faster and potentially with our help. And that's so rewarding, and helping people to do that both in our practices and maybe a little bit through this podcast. That's the goal, and that's the best part of what I'm doing.
I echo Rob's comments on the practice point and on the podcast point. I think it's been particularly rewarding for us opening up and inviting listener questions on our podcast, because we've heard from people right across our country. We've heard from people in the United States that listen to our podcast that have sent us sincere, meaningful questions. And to think, you know, we weren't even doing this a year ago, right? And so a couple of guys sitting in front of a microphone talking about a practice area, and then people trust you enough to send in a question and you address it. And we've gotten some really nice feedback from our audience. And that's been extremely rewarding. I've been taken aback, quite frankly, by the impact we've had in terms of reaching out to our listeners. So we're incredibly grateful to have our podcast, and we're incredibly grateful to have met you, Gil and Tim. It's been incredible just finally connecting in person. And because, of course, we've connected digitally over LinkedIn and other things. So it's been wonderful being on your podcast.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's been wonderful having you on the podcast and also talking about this stuff. It's, you know, family law. And sometimes you think, oh, is it bad that it's a passion? You know, it's not right. A great passion to have. you know, it is such an interesting and kind of all-consuming topic at sometimes. It's really nice to talk to other people about, you know, their experiences and what their motivations are. I think my takeaway from this discussion today is I think there, you know, we're kind of all dealing with the same human condition and separation process, just in different locations. Canada and Australia are obviously pretty similar, you know, in a number of ways. But it's been really interesting to hear you guys, you know, and how you kind of view these issues.
Well, yeah, we'll have to come down and see the is it Chambos? Is that the slang word?
Chambos. Hashtag Chambos. That we all like, you know, embrace.
It's catching on.
I was going to say the same thing, Darren.
I'm a fan. I'm a joiner. Tim's like more of a controversial element in our office, but I mean, come down anytime. Like, I mean, I think the borders,
international travel,
the flights are opening again at the start of next year, aren't they? So. Maybe we can talk to the powers that be in our firm that, you know, we need to have some kind of international conference on family law between, you know,
I'll bring some BC wine and we'll go surfing.
Yeah, well, wild. I'm in Newcastle, so we're just beside a wine region as well in the Hunter Valley. So we can all exchange wines and all the things.
Thank you so much, guys.
See you guys later.
You've been listening to I Do, I Sue, a family law podcast with Timothy Nichols and Gillian Yeend. To find out more about your hosts and what they do, visit chamberlains.com.au. And now, here's the bit the boss insisted we say. The information in this podcast is for general educational purposes only. None of the content should be considered legal advice. Please don't make decisions based on the information in this podcast without seeking professional legal advice of your own. For more information, visit chamberlains.com.au.